Adobe Express is the quick and easy create anything app. It has taken my content to the next level, making it simple to create everything I need to promote my business. From Instagram and TikTok posts to logos and flyers, all in just a few clicks. Build your brand with Adobe Express. Search for Adobe Express to find out more and get the app for free. Adobe Express, the quick and easy create anything app.
What type of console?
Controller.
Game did they want?
MPG.
RPG.
JRPG.
Bombo combo.
Haptic feedback.
Pancake lens VR headsets.
Razor ventilated mesh chairs.
Beta bots.
COD.
Bot
camping.
Steam. Famine.
Gaming's complicated. EE Game Store has kit, tools, and services to help you find the right gift. Gaming from the people who connect your life. Search EE Game Store.
Hey listeners, welcome back to Immigrantly. I am Sadia Khan. Can you believe we are already in November? I swear it feels like we were just stepping into spring and now we are bolting towards the end of the year. It's wild how time flies, especially as you get older, isn't it? I find myself constantly wondering, how do we slow down enough to truly cherish moments with loved ones? How can we declutter our lives to focus on what really matters, making these fleeting moments truly memorable? And to be honest, I don't have answers to all these questions. But I have invited somebody who does. Delcy Sandoval is a Guatemalan-American licensed therapist, visual artist, and co-host of the acclaimed Tamarindo podcast. She's also the founder of the Ocupacion podcast, where she highlights Latin American artists and visionaries. But her impact doesn't stop at podcasting. Delcy is the co-creator of Encuentro Creative Retreat, a unique space designed to nurture cultural creators through workshops and healing practices. Delcy and I talk about a lot of things, but especially how she blends art and mental health, the power of storytelling, and how to find moments of stillness in a world that's always in motion. I can't wait for you to hear our conversation, so let's jump right in. Welcome to Immigrantly, Delcy. It is happening finally. How long have we been at it? Like, how long have you and I been communicating for? I don't even remember now.
I think several months, maybe a couple of months.
Yes. I have interviewed Brenda. I interviewed Anna Sheila. And now I'm interviewing you. So I feel like I have this very strong connection with Tamarindo podcast and all the phenomenal women there. So I'm really glad we are having this conversation. And then you have a cat. I mean, come on. So good.
Thank you for sticking with it. You know, it's just a testament to how busy lives have become that it's hard to mesh two different schedules where people are doing a lot of things and extra projects and all of that. But it makes me happy that you're mentioning some of these women because they've been a big part of my life the past few years. And so I'm excited to connect with you.
I am so excited to connect with you as well. I've been listening to Tamarindo for a long time. But Delcy, before we get into the podcast and your work, your healing journey, let's take a step back and start from the very beginning. Talk to me about where you were born, raised, your childhood memories.
Yeah, so I am the child of two pretty spectacular people. They're both Guatemalan. and they came to the United States in the 80s during a civil war that was taking place in Central America that a lot of people are aware of. And Guatemala had its own version of that civil war, which made life in Guatemala really difficult. My parents had my older sister, and they were struggling to survive, specifically because they were targeting people who were in universities. And so my dad at the time was going to school, and so he had a lot of fear and a lot of things that were going on during that time. So they came to the United States, and I was born the year that they arrived. So this was, we kind of already starting in an interesting place, because my parents were undocumented at the time. They were in a new country, obviously didn't speak the language, didn't have a job. Neither of them had jobs. They were sort of here in this situation. And all of a sudden, my mom is pregnant, right? And she tells this story in a way that really puts my life in context, because it wasn't an exciting thing, right? It was a scary thing. That there was this additional life that was coming during that time. And so I think it's a good place to start. We lived in East Los Angeles, and I grew up there in the 90s. And it was this really incredible way of growing up, because I was right in the middle of a big moment in Los Angeles history, right? We had like Rodney King riots during that time. There was a big, big focus on gang life during that time, and also a lot around kind of media attention of Latinidad in general during that time. And so I grew up in this very interesting dynamic where I was sort of aware that it wasn't necessarily a good thing to be Latin in the United States. And one of the things that was very interesting was that my family, as a result of their background, didn't really talk to me a lot about anything that had to do with politics, right? It was something that sort of nobody wanted to discuss. It was a very, I think, sensitive topic. So it was not something that was talked about in the household. I remember really clearly, I would see the murals when we were driving in East LA. I would see all of these big murals from all these really important artists, right? Judith Baca, for example, or the We Are Not a Minority mural. And I remember it was the first time that I had any consciousness around political activism as Latinos, or the fact that there were other opinions out there about who we were. It was the first time. And I think that is the moment where I fell in love with art and I wanted to know more. From that point, I think it was the main thing that I paid attention to, is anytime there was some form of expression.
Before we talk about art, I want to go back to what you said about your parents, right? They weren't talking to you about politics. And I hear this from a lot of kids of immigrants, that their immigrant parents are not open about certain conversations. And being an immigrant parent, it really makes me pause and think about the conversations that I should have had with my kids, I should have with my kids. But going back to politics, what is it that you wish your parents had spoken about, discussed with you regarding politics?
Yeah, it's really interesting, because I look back at that time with a whole lot of empathy for my parents. Because right now, I am at the age that my parents maybe would have been when I was younger. And I realize when, you know, life is incredibly difficult as you, and especially as you get older. And when I think about their circumstances, I understand why this wasn't even an idea to talk to me about. And I think if it would have been helpful for me to understand a little bit more about the history of Latinos in Los Angeles, I would have liked to have known a little bit more about that, specifically the impact. And I think one of the things that I remember really clearly was going to Hollywood. You know, this was something that we never really did, but every now and then we would go out and do something, and we would go to Hollywood. And there was this huge mural of the actor Anthony Quinn, and he's sort of dancing. And it was one of the first times that I saw like a Latino face. in a prominent part of Los Angeles and made me realize that we had more history beyond the history that I was living in. And I think that would have been helpful. I'm not sure my parents had that context, but it would have been helpful.
That's what I was going to say, because as an immigrant, when I look back, our initial years of settling down in the US were so chaotic. And even now, I don't have context for a lot of things because I did not grow up here. I did not experience my childhood in the US. I did not experience my early teenage years in the US. So for me to contextualize what Muslim identity looked like in the 80s and the 90s and how much of it has changed or evolved is very difficult. Do you see that now that your parents probably didn't have the vernacular or the knowledge to have that conversation?
Definitely. I think I knew it all along, right? And I think when I say I wish I would have known, I don't necessarily think that it needed to have come from them. I think that there were many opportunities, you know, in school, for example, is a really great example, being that we were primarily Latinos in the school, would have been an interesting way to contextualize history. But I do think that that's why the artists in the neighborhood were up to the task, because I think there was some understanding of that these were immigrant communities and we were not the first to come. There was just a massive wave of people from Central America that came during the same time. But what was interesting about that too is like my parents were all of a sudden in a primarily Mexican environment. And so I know people think like, oh, well, everybody's Latino, but that's really not what their experience was. They had come from this very homogenous country, aside from, you know, the incredible amount of indigenous tribes and communities that exist in Guatemala. They had come from a generally homogenous culture from the area of Guatemala that they were from. And then they all of a sudden, they're in this space with people who are coming from an entirely different country. So I grew up with all of my friends being Mexican American. And so it is an interesting experience because I didn't actually meet another Guatemalan person who was my age, who was not a member of my family until I was almost, you know, 17 years old, maybe.
Oh, wow. How did that shape your outlook on life?
I think that it made me feel like there was something to discover all the time. Because I didn't have access to my pieces of my identity. They weren't easily there, right? So I had my parents, and now that I'm older, I realize that my parents kind of functioned within a little bit of a time capsule. And I didn't realize that at the time, but when you talk to my parents, you know, even the language that they use, they're using like 70s slang. When they're speaking in Spanish, you know, they're using 70s slang. The music they listen to is from the 70s. Like they basically, the moments of their life that were most joyous were their early 20s. And so they relive those moments over and over in the culture of the household. And at the time, I just assumed that that was Guatemalan culture because they were my only avenue to Guatemalan culture.
I love what you're talking about. It's the through line in every immigrant household. I feel like I'm stuck in early 2000s when I think about Pakistan. I haven't moved on. I haven't.
And what a great opportunity because, you know, for me, I get to engage with Guatemalan culture as it exists today when I am there through my cousins and through people that I connect with who are in the country now. And Guatemalan Americans that are coming to the United States right now and what that culture looks like. And I also have a very clear window into Guatemala of the past because my parents kept it alive so strongly. And it's a really beautiful time.
What are some of the differences between the culture of the 70s and the 80s that you saw growing up in your household versus what you're seeing as an adult?
My parents in the 70s and 80s, or what they have brought to the table is a big sense of community, a lot of collective sort of joy. And obviously, you know, let's be clear, I don't want to make it a utopia because, you know, there are dynamics within large groups of people, right? And gossiping and family drama and all those things. But there is this kind of goal everybody has to ensure that they're always together. And it seems like everybody has this goal. I have seen that shift a lot in newer generations as they kind of take on a more like hyper-capitalist experience like we're living. There's a lot of working and a lot of trying to achieve and so on. And so it becomes a more and more individual lifestyle. So that's something that I'm seeing a lot of. And I think also the openness that newer generations have to other parts of the world that may not be Eurocentric. So my parents came from a very Eurocentric existence. Everything that they liked or listened to often came from Spain or, you know, from other European countries. And I notice now with my cousins and people, you know, they're really into like Norteño music or, you know, sometimes music from India. And it's really cool to see sort of like indigeneity taking more of a forefront in the identity. And I think that's really beautiful.
What I'm hearing is that in this new culture, what's gained is more international, global perspective, right? And inclusive approach to human existence. And what's lost in some ways is the idea of community and collectivism, which older generations held close to their hearts and celebrated in a way. What is the balancing act in this, Delcy?
You know, it's interesting because I'm only speaking as a person from the outside looking in, right? Which is that I'm commenting on what people in the country of origin or from the country of origin are thinking and doing. But I think when you talk about balance, a really good way to think about that is to think about somebody like me, because I am a holder of both of these cultures in one space and also this American identity, right? And so there's a lot of this balance where I'm part of a new generation of Guatemalans, and I'm also, you know, somebody that grew up with my family kind of in this time capsule of that was our home. That I am so joyful and happy to have been a part of. And there's also this new sense of self as a Latino, as a collective Latinidad, and in general as a first generation American or part of a BIPOC community. And I do exist kind of in that balance, in that in between that is ever evolving. And I think that is the theme of what it is to have this mix of identities, is that you are not stagnant. There really isn't a moment where you can say, this is who I am now, and you hold on to it. It seems to be in a constant flux, and the openness and flexibility that you have to understand that you are Latina because that's who you are, and it is not necessarily something you need to do or something you need to achieve or something you need to follow. But rather, like, who I decide to become and who I evolve to be is what Latinidad is as a result.
That's your idea of who you are, right? But I wonder, how do others, especially those living in Guatemala, people who are local, perceive you?
I think that that's something that is changing a lot. When I was younger, I think there was a very clear divide. Right, which was, it didn't feel like I was Guatemalan in any way, which I can understand because I don't know, you know, a lot of the common knowledge, like certain slang words or even neighborhoods or any context to schools or any of the conversations that people would have. Even some of the major political things that have gone on, or maybe entertainment artists and things. Like, I wasn't super in the know. I did my best, you know, but I wasn't 100% local. I mean, you can tell I have an accent when I speak Spanish, you know, I speak a lot of Spanglish, all of that. And I think there was a little bit of a sense that I was foreign to them, although they were kin to me, which is a very interesting experience because I felt foreign in the US, although I was born here. And so I sort of felt foreign no matter where I went. And I think that's a common feeling that people who are like me experience. I will say that recently, because of the advent of the internet, right, and kind of the expansion of globalization, and also just the way that English has taken over the world, there are now a lot of young Guatemalans speak fluent English. I have noted that the gap is sort of not, culturally not as prominent. You know, my cousin, who's my age, is living a similar lifestyle to me, and we use similar slang words, and she speaks English, and we're listening to similar music because a lot of the music that she's listening to is no longer Eurocentric. And as a Latina in the US, I listen to a lot of Latin music. And so the gaps are starting to narrow. And as a result, I think we're gaining more commonality, and there's a little bit less of that rejection.
Do you see any places where these multiple identities clash?
Yes, absolutely. I think one of the things that is very interesting is I'm a big proponent, right, for therapy. And a lot of what happens when you are in therapy is really thinking about you, who you are, what you need to thrive, right? And sometimes that it means being an individual and thinking about yourself in a way that maybe I'm not programmed to do. And so there can be this kind of balance where as I start to establish boundaries or I start to really think about who I want to be and who I want to spend time with, it becomes more challenging to comply with some of the cultural standards that I was raised with. And sort of having to be okay with feeling nervous about maybe being perceived as selfish or even judging myself as maybe not being helpful enough to the collective, I think is the major battle that goes on within me.
Let's expand this conversation a little. I was listening to one of your episodes and you talked about decluttering your life. Talk to me about that. Have you been able to declutter parts of your life? And do you have any regrets about what you have let go of in the process?
I think one of the things that's important to know is that I have felt a lot of empowerment this year. I think because it's been one of the hardest years of my life, in all honesty. And I think when you have a lot of difficulties and a lot of challenges, it sort of forces you into this place of growth.
Hmm.
Which I think has taken me all year to come into that awareness and gratefulness around that process, because earlier in the year, I was sort of like, why is this happening? But now I feel very aware of it. And I answer that just to answer the part of your question around regret, because I realize that I am fully in control of my life, which I don't think I was aware of before. And as a result, you know, if I do something, if I make a decision that I don't feel good about, it's totally fair game for me to change it and to try again. And the people who have patience to be with me through that journey are the people that I want in my life. So I try to make these changes with a lot of grace and a lot of empathy and care. And, you know, I don't always get it right, but I want to make sure that people feel cared for, even if they don't understand the decisions that I'm making. Because the decisions that I'm making really, they're for me at this point in my life. They're for me. And I think it's the first time that I do that. When I thought about decluttering my life, it was really about like, why am I feeling so overwhelmed by my own decisions, by my life, by the amount of people in it, or the things that I do when those choices have been made by me? And so thinking through, having a very clear sense of like, how do I want to feel every day? How do I want to feel when I spend time with this person? When they're around me, how do I want to feel? And I want to feel, you know, I want peace and I want joy and I want connection. And I think narrowing it down made it easier for me to say, okay, I'm alert now. And if I'm feeling uncomfortable, if I'm not feeling that peace, that joy, that connection, then is this worth my time? And that is really hard because sometimes, you know, these are people who've been in your life for a long time. Sometimes there are activities that you went after. Sometimes they're plans that you yourself set up, and you're having to figure out how to respectfully back away from those moments to allow more time and space for what you really want to invite. It's a really difficult, painful experience.
I'm sure you've seen this in your therapy as well, right? You are a therapist and you work with other people, and you probably have these deeper conversations around vulnerability. And it seems like you've put yourself in those situations as well. But Delcy, I want to go back to what you said about you being in full control of who you are and what you can do and what you should do in a way. Do you think that's putting a lot of burden on yourself?
Yes, I do think that there are obviously systems in place and a lot of history, especially with my background and who I am. There are a lot of things that are either by design or just happen to be the case, or, you know, be kind of collateral damage after other schemes have been employed, right? There's a lot there that puts this massive barrier in front of me, or I think I see those as the current playing field. And I do a lot of work on my end to sort of fight against those systems. Or, you know, Tamarindo, for example, is one big way that I engage in sort of like activism and social justice and so on. It's a lot of my own voluntary time to kind of address these things. But I think when I think about how much agency I do have, it is pretty astonishing. Because despite those systems, there are many kind of everyday decisions that I do have control over that I, for a long time, sort of allowed to be decided by other people or even perceptions of other people that maybe weren't even accurate, you know? Because one thing that's really cool is as you get to know your parents and your family and your culture more and more as you get older, you realize like these people are not stagnant. They also change, but sometimes our perceptions of them are slow to catch up. And so even things that I've thought, oh my God, my mother's going to kill me if I do this, you know, and then I go talk to her and she's like, what? I love it. Let's do it. You know? And I'm like, what is happening? And she's using new words and I'm like, you know, what's going on? And it's amazing.
I hear you. It's as if we put our loved ones in this static space. We don't see them as humans who have emotions, who are living life, and their life experiences teach them so much. I'm curious to know, how do humans change, Delcy? And I want you to wear your therapist hat, because changing one's habits and character is not easy, right? And I'm curious to know, is it shame, a seismic event, love, connection? What triggers change in humans?
You know, there are so many theories of change. And so many ways to go about it. Everything you mentioned, the answer would be yes. There's so many catalysts for change. I think what's interesting, and an interesting way to think about this question, is more so what obstructs you from change would be maybe easier to answer. Because I think there are a lot of self-doubt and perceptions and maybe some older schemas, right? Ideas, ways of thinking about the world that kind of hold you in where you are. And sometimes that's for survival purposes, right? Like you're not able to continue on because you're just sort of trying to like stay afloat. And I think when you're either forced into change or you are open to change because the circumstances of your life have allowed you to enter that state where you're open to difference, I think that it can be exponential from that point. And to tie it into what we were talking about and using a personal example, because my mother came from Guatemala, she has never doubted that she is Guatemalan. And as a result, she has actually changed and grown in altered her perceptions of the world drastically by allowing kind of the U.S. to wash over her, because she wasn't holding on to this idea of what it meant to be Guatemalan. But me, on the other hand, because I was not born in the country and I didn't actually grow up around Guatemalans, I felt like I needed to be Guatemalan. So I created this idea, a very stagnant idea of what it was to be Guatemalan. And I went full force into it. And as a result, I stayed within those parameters for a very long time and did not seek out some of the things my mother has sought out. And I think recently kind of understanding these dynamics, that they're very common, that lots of people have the same experience as me, and letting some of that go and understanding who I could be, I have seen that barrier lifted and lots of change kind of take place.
What was the trigger for you?
I think for me, the trigger really was like health related issues, because, you know, you can put up so much pressure on yourself and your body can only take it for so long. And I think when I started to realize that I was having maybe like somatic responses to a massive level of stress, I sort of started to examine that stress further. And some of that stress really was stemming from what I perceived to be my culture, only to understand that it, you know, was a culture that I had designed and maybe was not the reality of how the culture presents.
Give me an example of your perception of your culture and the reality as you see it now.
So a really good example is like the femininity in my culture. So gender roles in my culture, for example, growing up, I felt what I thought was a lot of pressure to sort of dress in dresses all the time. And as I got older, you know, high heels and lots of makeup, and, you know, there's a lot of pressure to dye your hair, maybe a lighter color because of colorism and all of these different things. And I felt a lot of pressure to like look this way or present this way or make sure that I had a certain level of femininity that was appropriate for other people and so on. And I think, you know, that doesn't sound like a big deal to a lot of people maybe listening, but for me, identity-wise, it felt like I was in a constant costume. Or I was, you know, in some kind of like parody of myself. It didn't really feel authentic to me. And so as I got older, I started kind of playing more with what I wore and how I expressed, you know, my gender and so on, and the kind of woman that I felt that I was. And I really believed that this would be like, you know, chaos. If I went somewhere dressed how I wanted to dress, that people would say things, or it would be, you know, I wouldn't be accepted or whatever. And I realize now that there's so much more flexibility. And although I do think that that ideal standard is still something that exists within the culture, I realize that the people who care about me, love me, know me, support me, are not necessarily holding my value to this particular cultural idea of gender. And so I have the capacity to be more me and to appear the way I want to appear and what makes me comfortable, confident, and able to kind of face the world as dressed as myself and not as the version of myself that I think the culture responds to.
Delcia, have you had these conversations with your mother?
A little bit, here and there. You know, my mom and I have lots of really intense conversations. And this conversation has gone there a couple of times, you know, mostly when she'll make comments. You know, everybody knows about the mom comments.
Yeah, absolutely. I have a mom. I make those comments. I try not to. I seriously, guys, I'm being very intentional now. But I am curious to know how your mom perceives your understanding of how you present yourself and your gender now through what you wear and how you dress up.
I think that, you know, when I think about how she perceives what I'm wearing, for example, it's like everything is coded in all of these layers of like generational trauma, right? Where she wants me to look like a professional, like feminine woman, because this is what in the 70s in Guatemala was considered a respectable person that was treated as a respectable class, because there's a very almost like a caste system that goes on there. And being a Latina in the US, she's fully aware of how I am already perceived when I enter a room. So she is almost like in a protective stance, like make sure you always look, you know, appropriate, make sure you always look this way so that no one is having any thoughts about you and everyone treats you with respect. That's, she's coming from that place. And that's giving her a lot of credit, because I think there are also some other reasons, and you can imagine that why she would want to control how I dress. But I think now she's sort of understanding more and more that for me, the power is coming more from within, and the way that I feel about my life and myself, because we've had these conversations. And so I'm not dressing for others. I am dressing for me. And I think that the way people perceive me, you know, is impacted by how I perceive myself and how I'm entering a room, because I can't really adjust for what other people might want.
So how changing your dressing has changed others' perception of who you are? Have you noticed that change from other people?
I feel like I've noticed other people less and less, which is big in and of itself. It's also telling, because as I shift my mind state from thinking about what others might think of me to thinking about what I think of myself, it has completely changed the way I am living in the world.
What do you think of yourself?
I have quite a lot of care for myself in an external way that I think I didn't have before. Mostly like understanding myself as part of the human condition. I don't think I extended as much care or grace as I did to other people. Right? If my family member, yeah, to myself, if a friend was going through something, or if somebody I met, you know, was behaving a certain way or whatever, there was a lot of grace. You know, if my family didn't understand something or did XYZ, there was a lot of grace. But for me, there wasn't that same grace. It was like I expected myself to hit a standard that was really impossible in a lot of ways, and checked too many cultural boxes, like be the best American, like be the best Latina, be the best, you know, daughter, mother, be the best at work, be the, you know. And now I'm sort of seeing myself in context as like, this is what it is to be a human being. And I am in a constant state of confusion and figuring things out. And that doesn't change with age. I get older and I'm still as lost, right?
Which is not bad.
Yeah, it's the human experience. Yeah.
Confusion is good.
Yes.
Confusion leads to discovery and curiosity. So yes. There's nothing wrong with confusion. We don't need to have all the answers all the time.
Yes. And I think there was this idea for me that sort of like, if you did everything right, one day you woke up and it was all figured out. And now I'm coming to the conclusion that that's not the case, and that it's actually quite beautiful that that isn't the case, that there isn't kind of this like final destination, but rather like a constantness, you know, this constant experience of being alive. And seeing myself in that context has given me a lot of grace and almost a little bit of admiration for myself, in the sense of like, man, like, you have ridden the wave, right? Like you're kind of coming out the other side of a lot of things this year. And that same admiration that I have for other people that I see in the world who are living through a whole lot and still kind of maintaining that level of curiosity about the world.
You've granted it to yourself. Delcy, I want to circle back to what you said in the beginning. Art as a healing tool. We started the conversation there, how art became this tool for you to connect with your identity. If someone were new to exploring art as a healing tool, what's one unexpected exercise or activity you would recommend to them as a healer, as a therapist, that offers instant insight or relief through art?
I would say that not thinking of art as a proper noun is life-changing, right? When you think about art, you hear the word art, I think a lot of people think of institutions or, you know, museums. Maybe they think of a formal practice or formal education when it comes to art, or they're thinking about like world-renowned, the Michelangelos of the world, you know. And that is a massive barrier, because if you're thinking of art that way, then immediately you're out of the running unless you're some kind of genius or prodigy. But I think that artistic being, artistic thinking, creative thinking is a human right. And it is a human, almost like something that has gotten passed down, like a human tradition, right? And you don't need to create. You don't need to put anything on a paper. You don't need to go buy supplies and like figure out how to use them. You certainly can, and that's fantastic if you do. But simply letting your mind wander and allowing yourself what we call boredom, right? Allowing yourself to enter a state where you are perceiving things you've seen a million times in a different way, noticing their shape, noticing their form, noticing how they make you feel, what they make you think about. I think letting yourself have that kind of creative thinking that comes naturally to some and maybe is like a practice for others and maybe tied into mindfulness can be really powerful. And it can, I think, generalize in other areas of your life when you allow your brain to like recognize those kinds of connections, right? And I think that's setting yourself free artistically.
That's so interesting to me. Come to think of it, there's so much around us in our environment, in physical spaces that we occupy. But when we look at things, we don't look at their physical form. And what you just said resonates with me so much, because I'm pretty sure if I started to notice it more, I would discover so much, not just about that artistic visual or expression, but probably about myself as to where I pay attention.
Yes.
And, you know, where my gaze goes.
100%. And how much of that gaze is socially imposed, you can start to disarm some of those things, you know, how much of it has to do with the mental state you're in at that moment and so on, you know. It's like a big mirror, you know, the world is a big mirror to your internal world. And I think that there's like a feedback loop that happens when you start to pay attention to how you're engaging in the world or how the world engages with you. I think, for example, like this is going to sound really strange, but sometimes when I have to, you know, when I have a free moment or I have to wait, like one thing that I, like a game that I play with myself is I look at a space and I'll close my eyes and try to remember if I recall what I was just looking at. Like, do I know what's in this living room right now? And I will realize often that I don't know. Things that I have engaged with every day for a year, I don't know where they are. I don't know what painting is there. I can't remember what was on the floor. And I try then open my eyes and look at the things that I missed and try to pay attention to the things that I do notice and why, and pay more attention to the things I missed and so on. That is something that allows me the opportunity to get in the mind state of being more present, noticing more, and thinking through what that could mean about who I am and where I am emotionally at that time. And I think that kind of creative thinking or inner expression doesn't have to necessarily be on canvas for it to be kind of the rite of passage of human artistry.
If you were to go through this exercise with somebody else, right? When you see someone not noticing things around them, what does it indicate to you about their human conditioning?
I think it says a lot about where your values are at that time, or what you perceive to be most important in your life at that moment. And there's no right or wrong answer to that. It's more so the noticing part that's really magnificent, right? Maybe I don't notice my home at all because my mind is on my children or I don't notice my children at all because my mind is focused on my health issues, or maybe I haven't, you know, looked at my hands in a while. For instance, I had a very clear thought the other day while I was driving, and I noticed my hand on the steering wheel, and I realized that it looked different than the last time I remember looking at my hand, which means that it's been years since I've paid attention to my own hand. And it was this like very vivid moment. And it was an important moment for me because I want to be present for my life. And I want to see and I want to be on the journey with my body as it changes and grows old and things like that. That's important, a value to me. And so what you notice and so on, I think can say a lot about where you are in that time in your life and maybe where you want to go, where you do want your attention to go, where you do want your time to be spent.
As I'm thinking about this, I'm pretty sure there are moments in our lives where we subconsciously avoid looking at things closely, right? Because we don't want to be disappointed in a way, or we've been conditioned to see ourselves in a certain light. And if we look too closely, we'll find something that we don't want to reconcile with.
100%. There is a lot of self-protection that goes on. We do a lot to hide from the things that will hurt and will cause pain. And I think sometimes we're not ready to face some of those things. Sometimes we don't have the capacity because we're in survival mode. And other times it can be a matter of really exploring what you think your tolerance is for pain. You know, if you're able to face something and feel that pain, like, do you feel 100% certain that you will make it out the other side, that you will feel it and survive after and be able to tolerate that pain? I think that's something that we all kind of struggle with. There's a massive avoidance of pain. And doesn't that make sense, right?
Yeah, but it's as if certain cultures are so averse to pain and tolerating pain. It's almost as if we are erasing one human emotion and feeling out of our lives because we have associated so much negativity with it. Pain doesn't have to be painful.
And or painful, having something be painful doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to have a negative impact on your life.
Right. Painful in a negative way. Exactly.
Painful in a negative way. Like, it sounds strange to say it, but sometimes pain can lead to lots of other doors and other pathways and other opportunities and so on. I think you're right in saying that some of this is cultural, right? And I imagine all cultures have some version of this. But for me, my perception of this is that cultures that have historically had a lot of systemic trauma and a lot of, you know, just the trauma of immigration to begin with and all of that, I think you try to focus on making your home a joyful place, or, you know, making sure that there's always music playing and so on, and focusing in on the elements of the culture that are positive. Not all families do this, but certainly mine did. And that was in some ways wonderful, right? But in other ways, it made it clear, like, I received the message that this was not the space to talk about depression or sadness or anxiety or any of those things. That's how I perceived it, that there wasn't, that we were not allowed time to have those feelings. I realize now that there is time and there is space in my life, both for joy and for pain. And that sometimes, you know, even for example, like anxiety and excitement can feel exactly the same in your body. And so there are a lot of commonalities to the way we already can survive through a lot of these experiences of pain.
Oh, wow, Delcy, you and I could go on and on about this. This is such an important conversation for me because as you and I are speaking, in my mind, I'm having these moments of pause and introspection and thinking through this conversation in real time. sometimes good things have to come to an end. And as we wrap up this conversation, if you were to define the United States of America in the context of how it deals with pain, how would you do that?
I think that the United States rewrites pain. I think that we, as a country, make a concerted effort to rebrand pain in a way that is helpful to whoever is the person who's looking at that moment. I think we, when you think about how history has been rewritten, or books that are banned because they talk about things that are painful, even things we're not allowed to talk about culturally at the dinner table because they might be painful, we put our own spin on it culturally here in the US, right?
Not for everyone, though.
Not for everyone. Not for everyone.
We protect the dominant population from experiencing pain and shame.
I think that's a really beautiful way of putting it. And I think it also is a good way of reminding myself, because when you said the U.S., we as the U.S., like, that's where my mind went. And maybe that's an important thing for me to think about, because at this point, we are also a dominant culture here.
Where can people find the podcast, your work, Delcy? Is there a website they can go to?
Yes. So if you are into wellness, social justice, empowerment, then you might be into Tamarindo Podcast, and you can find us at tamarindopodcast.com. You can also find us on Instagram at Tamarindo Podcast. And then if you're really interested in art in particular, I also have a podcast that I host alone that is called Ocupacion. And that's Ocupacion. And this is on ocupacionpodcast.com and Instagram at ocupacionpodcast. And so these are the places that you can listen and kind of connect with me. I love DMs. Let's talk.
Thank you so much, Delcy. This was wonderful.
It was such a pleasure. Thank you for making the time.
Thank you. Thank you. Take care. And I will talk to you soon. I'm glad I was finally able to connect with Delcy to have this very important conversation. And as I said during my interview, there are few moments with my guests where I instantly start to reflect on how I engage with certain things that we talk about during the interview. And this was one of those conversations where I was doing that in real time. If you like this conversation, please share it with a friend, a family member, a colleague, a neighbor who may benefit from it. Look, guys, we are a small but mighty network. The content that we are creating is incredible, and we are so proud of our work. But we do need your help in terms of you sharing our content, subscribing to our channel on Apple Podcasts. Because you know this, advertisers, sponsors, all of that good stuff doesn't come easy. So we are really asking our listeners, all of you who come back every week, to help us out. You can subscribe to us, any of our podcasts, or our entire channel on Apple Podcasts. You can find links everywhere on our social media. You can look us up on Apple Podcasts app. And as I said, share the content. Give us a 5-star review. There are so many different ways to engage with us. And if you want to get more information about our work, my journey, how Immigrantly Media started, you can check us out at www.immigrantlypod.com. And you can always write to me at sadia@immigrantlypod.com. That's my name, sadia@immigrantlypod.com. This episode was produced by me, written by me. The editorial review is done by Shay Yu. Our incredible sound designer and editor is Lou Raskin. Immigrantly theme music is done by Simon Hutchinson. Other music by Epidemic Sound. Come back next week for another important conversation. Until then, take care and be kind to yourself.